John Florio joins us. He's the co-author with Wheezy Shapiro. The book is One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. I have truly enjoyed reading it. John, nice to have you on the show here.
Thanks very much for having me, Marty. It's good to speak with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So tell me, of course, this is an era that I lived through, and of course, I'm very interested in the impact of the world as it comes through the eyes of baseball. But tell me how the book came together for you, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the first topic we thought about was not the 60s in baseball. We were originally sitting down and thinking that one of the greatest stories in baseball in our minds is the release of Ball 4 in 1970, Jim Boughton's tell-all. You know, your younger listeners may not remember it. They'd probably be interested in it. The older listeners will remember that in 1970, that book came out. We all had it under our pillows at night. We were all reading a chapter at a time. You know, Jim Boughton is telling stories about what went on with Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford. There's all these behind the locker room door inside stories, you know, and it was just a fascinating read at that time. It was the first book of its kind. So Wheezy and I were sitting and saying, how are we going to tell this story? We started talking about all the events that led up to that. Now, that's 1970, right? So we're looking at publishing changed a lot over those years. Well, you know, the game changed a lot. You had the union start in the 60s. Well, what about race? Race really changed. You know, it really paralleled the civil rights movement that was going on in society. All of these things are paralleling what went on in society. We started talking about it, and Jim Boughton's book was part of it, but it wasn't really the whole story. So we zoomed out. And we started looking at what happened in baseball from 1960 to 1970, how the country changed, but also how the game changed along with it. And then that became our story. And in researching it, you know, we just found, you know, you have read the book, so you know, but there's just hundreds of great stories and things that were happening at that time, not only in the country, but in the game. And they kind of paralleled each other. So that became our book.
Oh, I love it. Some of the things that I've had on the show, of course, the integration of baseball.
Sure.
In the 60s, now we all think 1947, it was all over then. Not exactly.
And no, not at all.
And I was in South Florida in the late 50s and early 60s before I went to the University of Florida to college. And certainly I saw much evidence of segregation when I grew up, but it really still was a segregated spring training in Florida, which caused a lot of problems for the major league teams and a lot of problems with the old values that they had in Florida at that time.
Sure. Well, you know, the Jim Crow laws were still going. Those were really holdovers, but it was codified into law that public facilities were segregated. All of the segregation was still going on. So even the players who were used to living in an integrated society, guys like Bill White, who were, they were not, this was 1960, early 1960s America. So when I say integrated, there were still issues, a lot of issues going on. But when they went down to Florida, it was actually in the law. So they weren't able to, guys like Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Bob Gibson, Curt Flood, these guys are icons of the game, you know, they weren't even staying with their team. They had to find their own housing and had to go out on their own and see if they could find, quote, colored housing to stay because they couldn't stay with their own team, which, of course, also, you know, strictly from an on-the-field play point of view, I mean, there's so many things that are wrong with that, but from the on-the-field perspective, the chemistry of the team was also broken up as well. The guys didn't know each other as well as they would have because the teams weren't staying with each other. All the black players down there staying with each other, and the white players were staying with their teammates. So, you know, you had this kind of division going on. It was actually the Dodgers that ended up breaking that down with Dodger Town, and they out on in Vero Beach, they brought their team together. And, you know, we're talking to Peter O'Malley. He said he thinks it was one of their secret weapons, that it gave them chemistry on the field that the other teams didn't have.
Well, of course, once they left Dodger Town and went into Vero Beach, it was a different story. And I remember those days quite well. John Florio is with us. The book is One Nation Under Baseball. Give me a few of your favorite news issues applying to baseball, some of the things that are in the book. As I tell you, I like this book. It's fascinating. It's a subject I'm working on now. And I'd like to hear some of your favorite interesting anecdotes.
Well, I think one of the, you know, we were always trying to find the parallels of what was going on in society and how it affected the game. And, you know, there's a ton of them in the book, but one of them that I found really interesting was Bob Gibson's performance in 1968. You know, that may have been the best pitching season. I mean, there's certainly an argument, a strong argument. It was the best season in baseball history. Untouchable that entire season. And we were speaking with Tim McCarver about it, and we said, you know, what do you think it was that made who caught Bob Gibson that year? He was his battery mate. And we said, what do you think it was that made Gibson, you know, so incredibly unhittable for an entire season? He said, well, you know, from a performance, from an athletic standpoint, wherever I put my glove, he hit it. He said he had control the entire season long, from the beginning of the season to the end. He said, you know, pitchers dream of having control like this for three innings. He says he had it the entire season, to the eighth of an inch. Wherever I put my glove, he hit it. He said, so right there, he had that. But he was also talking about, and this is where the book, you know, our issue of the 60s and society and baseball come together. You know, I said, well, where did he get that competitive fire? He said, well, Gibson was always competitive. But that year after the Martin Luther King assassination, he was so angry that he somehow was able to channel that anger and really put it into his pitching performance. You know, there wasn't a lot that black players could do back then. If they were angry, they weren't allowed to speak. This was right in the heart of it, 1968, and he put it into his pitching. And, man, was he unhittable when you put that combination together, you know. And that's an example of, you know, society and baseball coming together.
1.12 earned run average for Bob Gibson.
Yeah, unbelievable.
I know. I remember it well, and it was unbelievable. And McCarver was a big part of that. 1969, the Mets win. And a lot going on in New York in those days. And, of course, 1969 for me was, I was that summer I was at Fort Jackson in the U.S. Army Reserve, but I was still a law student at that point. And I remember Kent State was shortly thereafter. But 1969, New York Mets, they win, but a lot going in New York. Mayor Lindsay and Bowie Kuhn. Tell that story.
Well, the Lindsay story is a classic, and this was one that I didn't know. You know, I was just a kid at this point. At 69, I was 8 years old, and I grew up by Shea Stadium. You know, you and I have spoken about this. I grew up by Shea, so you had to be a Met fan or a Yankee fan back in New York in those days. You couldn't kind of straddle it, and I was a Yankee fan back then. So digging into it now and really appreciating the team on another level, you know, through adult eyes, you know, I'm ashamed to say I was rooting against that team because, man, they were a great team to root for, such an underdog team. But now that I'm going back, like, I'm rooting for them through history. I know they're going to win, but I'm reading it. I'm rooting for them. And the interesting thing about that one is that Lindsay was very far behind in the polls for a number of reasons. But politically, he was seen as very liberal. He was, you know, he had not captured New York. There were quality of life issues going on in New York at the time that, you know, snow falls had come. He didn't have the plows out in time. He was really in disfavor. But not a baseball fan, by the way, Lindsay, but he happened to walk into the 69 Mets after they won the playoffs. And there's a photo of, I think it was Gaspar. It was over. Jerry Grody is pouring a bottle of champagne over a teammate's head. And then they see Lindsay, and he's this stiff, upright, you know, waspy kind of guy with the starched white collar. And they're pouring the champagne on him, and he's giggling as they're doing it. And the photographer captures that shot and runs it in the paper of Lindsay being in the – I mean, it's simply the mayor being in the clubhouse celebrating with the team that just won, you know, that just won it. And he that ends up turning the polls. Lindsay becomes a favorite because all of a sudden people see him as the New York guy. They see him as an underdog because he's tied to an underdog who can win. He's tied to that amazing Met team, and he goes on to win the election. And a lot of people point to that photograph of him with the Mets, and he wasn't even a baseball fan, big baseball fan, and as turning the tide for him.
Boy, very interesting. Plus, there are issues around the flag and political issues around there that impacted baseball.
Well, yeah, you know, there was an issue of raising the flag at the game. By the way, speaking of flags, one of the great stories in the book, I think, is Jose Feliciano in 68. I'm sure you remember this, when he went out and sang the Star Spangled Banner during the World Series, and
Detroit,
he did a blues version. And I can remember my parents watching the TV going, what the heck is he doing? He's just, you know, and I didn't really understand. Like I said, in 68, now I'm 7 years old. I just want to see the ball game. But I'm going back, I'm looking at it, and the scoreboard, the switchboards are lighting up at NBC, telling them to take this off the air. He's disgracing the national anthem during, you know, the war. They feel that he's not showing respect. They cut the camera away. They leave it on TV, but you don't see him singing it. They're cutting to various thing to various people. The band that was behind him and supposed to play doesn't join in. They're just standing there. So he's singing it alone. And he ended up ruining his career for a long time. He was blackballed from radio for singing the Star Spangled Banner in this way at a ball game. And he ends up coming back, and people, you know, with a more looking back in retrospect, see it as a different moment. They see it more as a seminal moment in music and in baseball and in interpretation of the Star Spangled Banner. But at the time, they didn't. And we viewed that as, like, this is unbelievable. I mean, it's the music world, it's baseball, it's society coming together at this moment, and it ruined a guy's career when he actually did a beautiful rendition of the Star Spangled Banner, one that was, if it were done today, would be completely accepted. Nobody would notice it. Yeah, it would absolutely be unremarkable. But back then, it made headlines in it, and it really derailed his career. He was a rising star, and all of a sudden, he couldn't be found on radio.
Yeah, I think it was in the Detroit.
Yes.
Because he was from Detroit, and I think that was the issue. I think that was...
Yes.
He was
there, and he stayed. And, you know, he said afterwards, he was doing, it was a love letter. He saw the song, his interpretation, as a love letter to America, for thanking it for all it had brought to him. Like, it was the exact opposite of disrespect. You know, he said, "I love the country so much that I was thanking it. I didn't even know. I finished. I was happy. I sat down, and then we left the park. And then, I didn't realize until afterwards what I had done when I saw what was going on in the news."
Boy, what a story! Well, that was the 60s, believe me, and you just scratched the surface of it, but the book is terrific. I'm going to use it in a lot of my research and with American Innings of what I'm doing with that, looking at the history of America through the eyes of baseball. This is terrific. I'll enjoy having you on. The book is One Nation Under Baseball. You get it anywhere, I assume?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold, it's out there.
Yeah, I always say the book tree in Montclair. I saw David yesterday. I like the private bookstores, but very well done. And
that is a great bookstore, by the way. People in that area should go there.
Oh, very good. I'm glad you know of it.
Yeah.
But very, very well done. I appreciate it, and look forward to having you on again. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Marty. We'll talk soon.
Very good. John Florio, Florio. This is I'm going to use this one, believe me, for what I'm doing with American Innings. I really like it.